October 4, 2011, it's the Watt from Pedro Show.
Thank you.
Watt from Pedro Show. I'm in Pedro, and I'm in my pad, in fact. Started off with John Coltrane, along with Eric Dolphy, joining the quartet there, with Impressions Live, and then Deep Under by Suaco. And with me here in my pad is special, special guest, Devin Hoff, incredible bass player. Recently has located here to SoCal. Welcome aboard.
Thank you, thank you.
South Pasadena.
Thank you, Conrad. Thanks for having me. Yeah, for now. Yeah.
That's what Nels told me. I was talking with him, and he said, because you were in that pad.
Mm-hmm.
But now you're subleasing one of his buddies.
Yeah, or one of my buddies, actually.
Oh.
Yeah.
Who is it?
You know, Chris. Chris Cohen.
Yeah. Maybe five or six.
Mm-hmm.
There's a few guitars.
Yeah. He likes it real...
dense.
Yeah, real dense and...
and in that room at the smell, whoa.
Yeah.
Even with Dose, we like playing in the front one because, man, it's kind of a den. They just hung some shit there.
Oh,
that
yeah.
That cat there is so nice. What's his name, Jim?
Jim, yeah. Yeah,
he's
super
best.
Nice. I haven't seen him in a while, but he's always been super sweet
to
me.
Yeah, yeah. But the room is just all that brick. If they just hung some shit, not too much. Don't want to make it dead, but just a little more to get a... anyway, enough about that. When did you get your pop? You know, came to Pedro here with your mom.
Yeah, and you hung.
We had a rap.
That was nice of you, man.
Yeah, they wanted to meet me, and I know he was a player. In fact, he gave me a CD of him doing blues.
Uh huh.
So was that your earliest music? Is hearing him?
Yeah. When I was a kid.
No, Carl, we should go back. It's Colorado. He's not from here, people.
Yeah, Fort Collins, Colorado, I was born, and it was cool because they kind of, my folks for a while had this time-sharing arrangement with me and my brother, so my dad would stay home when he was gigging at night, my mom would do her job, you know, she worked, like, you know, in the college up there, doing like a... at first, secretarial work and, you know, admin stuff.
I think that's an Aggie school.
Yeah, exactly.
I remember playing there once.
Wow.
On campus, and there's lots of cats with cowboy hats.
Yeah,
like,
man.
For real.
It's for real. It, you know, when I grew up, it kind of started changing as I was growing up and getting less and less rural and more like, more of a college town, you know. With
right, and also tracks. Their I-25 between there and Denver started filling up.
Exactly.
Lufkin?
Loveland. Yeah.
These towns like that started filling in.
Totally.
You can imagine how much different it was in the older days.
And it was, it's unrecognizable now. When I take people back there on tour or something to show it to them.
Billy lives there from the Senate.
They all came out there, actually.
And he's got a studio there called Blastin' Room.
Mm-hmm. My good friend Chip Guthrie was a punk rock promoter in town, and he brought the Descendants to town, and they ended up...
oh, wow.
Maybe I played for him in that theater.
There was a theater downtown, small one.
Was it the Aggie Theater? Yeah. That might have been that guy, Scoo. Might have been... but it might have been Chip, too, that put that on. You know? It was like... yeah. There was a small...
that's a good thing about Alzheimer's. You always meet new people. But anyway, your pop's playing guitar, so this is the first music you hear.
Yeah, and so he would stay home and practice all day, and I would hang, you know, because I was, like, before I went to school, but I remember real clearly him practicing certain things, and there was this local trumpet player named Hugh Reagan, who's a, he still plays with, like, David Murray and Roscoe Mitchell and these people. He was a devotee of, like, the AACM school, but because of his family and his work and stuff, he just hung out in Colorado. And so he would come over once or twice a week or something, it seems like. And my dad and him would play records, and they'd sit around and practice some bebop.
Wow.
And so he would come over, and they'd listen to, like, you know, Charlie Parker records and stuff. But they'd also put on, I remember very distinctly hearing this music that felt like I had to get up and run around the room, you know what I mean? And oftentimes it would be, I realized later, like, you know, Lester Bowie and stuff like this. Yeah, and, you know, and the art ensemble and that was music that... so I think from an early age my ears were messed up because I didn't hear dissonance as dissonance. Because when I was four, I thought that
You weren't hearing like the straight pop over the radio.
Yeah, and my dad would practice like bluegrass stuff or something just to keep his chops in it, and then he'd play this stuff. So my ears, it took me a while to sort out what were the right notes and what were the wrong notes.
Yeah, maybe not a bad thing. The right notes, the wrong notes.
You know, in other people's
eternal war.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I'm still figuring out, actually, now that I mention it, I still don't know.
Well, I think for a long time, maybe Nels was telling me that Bach came up with, maybe we should put the third here.
Hmm.
For a lot of time with Europeans, they didn't really,
right.
I think Newton helped him with some physics or some calculus or something to find out where maybe mathematically.
Whereas you're working like in Pythagoras. And you know the Pythagoras thing is supposedly inaccurate, right? Which is why you have to like adjust as you go up the octaves.
The tempo.
He thought it would work out, and it doesn't work. I mean,
no. In fact, there's this whole... Yeah, Thurston told me about this.
Hmm.
Mick Jagger told me never to drop names.
Oh, okay.
But he told me about this guy, Lamont Young, and right? He's this well-tempered...
Yeah.
They've come up with another way. No, this is how nature actually works it out.
Yeah, and like, you know, Rod Poole, guitar player, he was a big advocate of like the just intonated guitar.
Right.
It's so beautiful sounding. But
I went to that house. There's a dream house. But I don't know what it's called, New York. He's got a tune that's going for like years.
Oh, really? Oh, nice.
Yeah.
That they're just cycling through.
And it's these chords based on these well-tempered things.
Whoa. That's
so
cool,
interesting.
Man.
But at that time, you didn't know. You're just a kid running around in your hearing.
Yeah, and I'm just hearing my dad and his friends do all this, you know, and so all those players, my dad was like a... He was one of these people who was like an acid rock musician, I guess is the only word for it, you know, like a blues rock or something, you know what I mean? He was of that generation. And so his bandmates were all my uncles, my extended family and stuff, you know, they're all really cool guys. And then, and you know, the people were all around like that. And a bunch of long-haired Colorado dudes. So they kind of had this like rocker, early rocker vibe, you know, but then they also, you know... We're all kind of rednecks from there too, not in the racist sense or anything, but just in the accidental sense. You know?
Well, geography, look
yeah,
what it is.
You just can't help it. So
God, the nearest big town, really big town, would be Chicago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because Denver's was still kind of a cow town at that point,
right.
Frankly, you know. Although to me, it was
Chicago's a big town for Midwest people on the coast don't realize it.
Yeah,
they really don't realize it.
That's what I kind of figured out hanging out there a bit. Yeah, they. And it's
big shoulders.
Yeah, totally. Right. Big shoulders.
Let's hear some music. We'll be right back.
They're like, totally.
Okay. Watt from Pedro Show, we're back. We listened to Light. I'm going to get to see them next month.
Nice.
With Chameleon Eyes. And then Jackson Head from Boris. After that. And then the beginning, Joaquin A. That's volume 3. Now we've heard all 3 volumes of that. I guess it's kind of instrumental story of that band. It's a trippy band, these guys. Maybe they'd be in the tune to where your pop and his friends were. They're into jams.
Yeah.
They don't do any tunes.
It's just jams.
It's jams. It's jams. They had me last year. They brought me to this studio, and there was like 14 or 15 of them.
Wow.
They were just, you know, wanting a jam.
Wow.
It's their whole thing. It's like getting a spirit going. They're not so interested in using music as like to build compositions. The composition is in the moment while they're playing it. Very interesting.
Yeah.
So,
sure.
It's
a lot of energy.
You listening to your pop and his buddies do this stuff. When did you get the urge?
Early on, there was some guitars lying around. So my brother, who's older, my brother Brent, who's older, he and I both got into it. And we were the only kids. And so we would just pick up the guitars and learn a bar chord or something. Yeah.
Your pops.
Yeah, exactly.
Did he dig that?
My dad. So he thought it was great, you know. The first.
Oh, he didn't bum on it? Like,
No, he had like, I'm the first guitar that we played, he did it on
purpose. Oh, he had some beaters?
Like, yeah, he had like some $20 harmony sitting around, you know. And that
harmonies,
was
I remember those.
Yeah, and that was it. That was like, but it plugged in and still worked. And,
yeah.
You know, so I learned a bar chord. My first band was I was in fifth grade, and I remember my dad taught me like a Clash song on the guitar because it was on, you know what I mean? And then I might be getting my stuff backwards. And I heard X, and I got all like excited. I was
a little
kid. Yeah, and I was like, so I got out the harmony and we plugged it into a practice amp into some earphones and pointed the earphones out so it distorted real good. And my friend Mike came over and we had a ripped up snare drum with the head all taped up with masking tape. And my buddy Harley at the time came and we had a band we called the Pigs. That was my first.
Pigs.
It was a punk
fifth
band.
Great.
Yeah, and we were I don't know, man.
What were you doing? You were doing X songs?
No, we were doing our own.
You're
we couldn't play
your,
anything.
Your own
yeah,
tunes.
We're just doing our own tunes and
do you remember some of them first songs?
Man, I don't. Well, I remember one that's called the Green Bay Pig, and I have no idea.
The Green Bay Pig?
The Green Bay Pig, yeah. My friend at the time, Harley.
What's fifth grade, 10?
Yeah, something like that. He was an angry cat. He actually wanted to go and kind of off a little bit. He was an angry dude, so, you know.
He kind of turned up in the...
Totally. It was whatever teacher
itself.
Or other kid he was mad at the time.
Did you guys do gigs or was it just jamming in
the
band?
No, we just jammed in the basement. And then my brother, anyway, started a band and needed a bass player. And so around that time...
That's when
I switched, yeah.
So what did you know about basses?
I knew about, I always liked basses. I remember the bass player, Mark Hagelin. Mark actually passed away this year, but I remember going and tripping on his basses, you know what I mean? And like.
Oh, you'd bring him over to the pad?
Yeah, or I'd go to where they practiced, I guess. I can't remember. And just, I liked the rumble of it when I'd sit on the floor.
Yeah.
And I remember, like trying to, I would mess with them, I'd always be like pushing on the basses, but not touching the other stuff. So my dad remembered that, and he was like, I think you like that, and I realized that's what I would gravitate
to. Your brother needed.
My brother needed it. And
that's why, he was putting together a band.
Well, totally, yeah, that's the thing. That's always the story, though, right? Like, you play bass.
Now that's what happened to me.
Yeah, I thought you were with D-Boon.
It was D-Boon's mother, but same idea.
Oh,
you're going to make
idea.
A band.
Yeah.
Yeah, she wanted... She actually wanted us in the house after school so we wouldn't get into trouble. It was in the projects.
Yeah.
It was the early 70s. There was a lot of guns, but, you guys stay in the house and you guys play. I mean, this was arena rock. I had never been to a club. We had no idea you could do gigs.
Right. You thought you could only do stadiums.
Yeah. And we weren't going to be doing any stadiums.
Exactly.
So we're just, this is how we hang out after school. And she was a guitar player. So she had her son play guitar. And, you're going to hang out with them? well, you're going to have a band, and you're going to be the bass player.
Wow.
And I didn't
know. Because D. Boone was already playing at that point.
Because she was a guitarist, so she had him play. Actually, he kind of wanted to be the bass player. We didn't know what it was. Arena rock, you were so far away and shit. We didn't know how to hear it on records yet.
Yeah.
I remember playing the Creedence records and fucking could not hear what the bass player was doing. I could hear it in the Motown, Aunt Whistle, Bruce with the Cream, Larry Graham on the Sly, Jamerson, of course, with the Motown. But I could not hear it on a lot of, like, the T-Rex records, the Creedence records.
Right.
With the Sabbath, I'd get it mixed up with the guitar. You know, I could kind of hear him. But, man, it was mysterious to us. We didn't know because we had never been to a little gig. We've never...
Yeah.
And when I started on it, I never even really saw a real bass up close. I didn't know they even had bigger strings. We thought they were four-string guitar. But...
That's great, man.
Embarrassing.
So the first time you heard somebody live... right in front of you was...
Well, the first gig was T-Rex, and it was, you know, 3,500 other people, and so it was... You were far away.
Right.
One of them up there was the bass player. We knew in the pictures it looked like a guitar, but it only had four of the tuners.
But you guys were studying
I didn't know it was bigger string. No, I just played a guitar with four strings.
Oh, really?
We just thought they had thinner necks. We didn't realize. And I was 16 when I saw... First bass up close. There was one at Chuck's Sound of Music. They used to sell instruments with records. There wasn't really music stores that much. There was a couple in Hollywood, I think, Wurlitzer Organ or something. But and there'd be school band things. And there was some of that stuff here, too. But also records. It was way different.
Wow,
you
man.
Know, later in the 70s, they got into, like, record stores and music instruments and this. And then... Rock and roll, shit hard center in this. But that wasn't there in the... Yeah, so anyway, there's a bass there, and I remember tripping on this thing. I couldn't believe it. Like, I didn't really know what it was. It was like these big fucking cables.
Yeah.
And it was right when I started high school. First week of 10th grade. And, and somebody said, you know, I told somebody in a homeroom that I was, a badge buffing it. I play bass and shit, and this cat's there, and he goes, "What are you tripping?" And I said, "Look at this! Can you believe this thing?" You said, "I thought you were a bass player." And I said, "I am." He goes, "Well, that's a bass." And I said, "I know that, but I fucking didn't know that. I fucking couldn't believe it. I thought first thing I thought was, no wonder there's only four of them.
Don't live so
because they're big.
Yeah,
you work this song. What?" Worked real hard and got $100 up for a K.
Uh-huh.
This thing, man, it had... Devin's got his stand up here, and I bet you its action is about 10,000% lower than this.
Oh, my God.
This thing
is
like a King Arthur thing. You're like shot... Or Robin Hood, you could have shot arrows with this fucking thing. The action was so bad.
You have to hold the strings on with your forearm. Yeah. No finger.
It was bad. Oh, man. Anyway, that's my story. So I didn't, you know, my pop was, he wasn't music. You know, my ma sang for a band and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and her father played some guitar in vaudeville, she said, for a little bit. He told me, too, some stories. $2 a gig.
Whoa.
Yeah. For a whole band.
Wow.
People throwing shit and stuff. It was during the Depression.
Oh, yeah.
But... I didn't really have a music connection like that, so I stumbled through it. But here you're in the prac pad and you're fucking feeling it. So your bro's putting together the band. He needs you.
He needs me, and he's playing like I don't know, like kind of, you know, the stuff that people were playing at that time. So it's like
there's
Tom
a trio.
Sawyer, you know what I mean? Yeah. So it's playing like Rush tunes and Ozzy tunes.
Rush.
You know? Yeah. So the first thing I do is try
to
learn.
Always get asked about Rush because we had three guys.
Oh, man.
And where we came from, it was all, you know, three guys. Oh, Cream.
Yeah.
But like nobody knew about Cream anymore, hardly.
They only knew about Rush.
Rush. Oh. Huge.
Yeah.
Yeah, I took Miss Peek to see them a couple years ago.
She told me about that.
I fell asleep again because I went in the 70s with my pool cleaner friend Tony and fell asleep with that one. And like 20, 25 years later, I fell asleep again. Maybe 30 years later, yeah.
The soothing sounds, man.
I mean, I met one of them at a thing once, and they're nice people. And you can tell they're good musicians.
Sure.
So that's what you were doing. You were copying records.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
kind of like us. That's what we did. We copied.
Mm-hmm.
So you went from writing your own tunes with the Green Pay and Pig.
Yeah.
No, the Pigs.
The Pigs, yeah.
Yeah, the song was Green Pay. To your brother's band and copying songs off records.
Yeah, and that band's called Circus with a K. And our drummer, Jay, was a big prog rock guy, so he would write all these
Pert
lyrics and stuff. Yeah, he was
well,
in a Pert and Bruford.
Did he know that the Rush drummer wrote the words?
Yeah, well, he did, so then he had to write some words. You know what I mean? Jay's a cool
Ozzy,
guy.
Ozzy, you know, he didn't write his.
No, Geezer.
Bummer. Yeah.
Yeah, right? Geezer's the shit, man.
I found out later, but...
See, that's the stuff that still... Like, see, all that stuff you listen to as a kid, like Sabbath still stays
yeah.
with me.
So,
you know,
yeah.
X still
too.
Stays with me. And from the stuff from before I heard, because it wasn't until years later, my buddy Chip I mentioned earlier, like I met him and he was the one who really turned me on to like real punk rock. You know what I mean? So
yeah.
he was the guy who I...
Your brother missed it, even though he's older.
Yeah, he kind of got it through me. You know what I mean? I think. I
wow.
mean, he might dispute that.
There's
but I think,
some little brother stories, you know. That's the story of Creedence.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Tom's the older one.
Oh, and John.
John took over the band.
Yeah.
I think it was like a prom band or something. Like a, they were the Gollywogs and the Blue Velvets or something. And then he turned
and
into
John's
Creedence
like, no,
and wrote these songs.
We're going to do our own songs.
And yeah, I'm going to do the songs.
Yeah.
And back the other guys, and then they started complaining. And there's one record, that my last one, Mardi Gras, said, you're going to write your own. Well, Tom had left by that time.
Oh, right.
It's terrible. I don't even have that one.
Oh,
I only
really?
Play the six. I don't play the seven.
Yeah, it's like that
yeah,
sometimes.
It was weird. But there, sometimes the little brother comes and shows the big brother
yeah.
what's
well,
up.
Well, I mean, I fell into this stuff because who was around. And, I got a lot of things from him, but I think that just because of the people that I knew.
Yeah.
My friends. And, you know, so I learned, you know, it was all...
Were you guys doing gigs or was it just practice?
We were doing gigs.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, we were doing like we kind of fell into like a metal scene that was in town at the time. And then,
this is your high school?
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's play some.
Yeah.
I mentioned this to you before about this scene in Italy called Jazzcore.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to play a bunch of stuff here.
Nice.
And I'll get back to your story.
Make you baseball. The players are taking a field and we're set to win this event, which will make it even more than rising attention. Oh, yeah, this one's going to be a banger. First batter steps into the box. Oh, this guy's deadly. All hot dog and no bun. And folks, that guy's got a handful of nuts. The pitcher spits in his hand and gets ready to deliver the first ball of the game. Onlookers marvel as he lets it loose.
Watt for Pedro show. Folks, you didn't hear anything from Italy there. We're going to have to wait a little later in the show because, man, this block of music I had is too big for the space we got in the first hour here. So, in fact, I've played something that somebody asked me to play that I thought I lost. And it's Bed by Ben Chartre. And then we heard something from Florida. I don't know where Ben's from. But somebody asked me to play it, so I said, sure. And then Grover by Snore. They're from Florida. And then I think a Hollywood band, She Begins to Move by White Coffin. This stuff that I was going to play in the third hour, but that's where I'll play from the Fratelli.
Uh-huh.
because their block is big, and we'll play that in the third hour there. I was just getting caught up in Devin's tale of his music journey. So your brother, band Circus, you're playing with, and you're in with the metal scene. Well, that goes kind of good with that Hollywood song there.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, the metal scene in Fort Collins being about, you know, 10 people at the most, you know what I mean, at that point in time. And one of them went on to fame as the singer for Yngwie Malmsteen. That was like the big claim to fame for the town.
Whoa.
Like this dude, Jeff, he was in town. He'd come over to my house, you know, my folks' house, and jam in the basement with my brother and I. We would always screw in the blue light in the jam room, you know, so we could get into the vibe.
You ever heard the Yngwie tape of him on the plane?
No.
Yeah, somebody had a little recorder, and I think there's some bledge with some lady behind him was hearing him talk kind of, I don't know, weird, she thought. So she poured a Coke over in his hair, you know. And he was like, whoa. He couldn't believe it. He's going off, you know, you bitch, you have unleashed the fury, you know. And this guy, it's hilarious. You never heard it?
Got this recording?
I got to find this.
Oh, I got to hear it.
I think I played it once on the show, but it's up there with the Buddy Rich thing, but a different kind of.
I could
same kind of vibe, but yeah. A different reason, coming from a different point.
Yeah, yeah, coming from blow instead of a.
but the guy I went to see Rush with the first time, he was into that kind of play.
Yeah,
the more notes were the better.
The more, yeah, I just fit them all.
So, you didn't go too much further with Circus.
No, man, Circus stopped around then, and we, my brother and I kept playing together. In fact, we made music together. I was actually talking to Kira about this. It's kind of like her and her brother, where you just keep making tapes over the years, you know.
Yeah, she's done that long time.
Yeah. So my brother and I, we're actually about to do some more stuff, I think. It's been a while for us, but that's the reason I moved to San Francisco originally.
Oh, is that where he's living?
Fast forwarding years. Well, he is there again.
Okay.
And he was in New York in between for a while, but he moved out there from Colorado. And then I came out like a year or two later because we had had our bands had progressed. We had started writing songs.
Well, what happened after Circus?
Well, we got into like the punk scene, you know.
Okay.
That's what happened.
So that band's over. That's too embarrassing.
Yeah, that band, we can't do it anymore, you know. And Jay, our drummer at the time, was not feeling the other stuff. You know, he wasn't feeling like all
the. A lot of those dudes, if you know about those older days when punk was way minority.
Yeah.
A lot of dudes who could play was not into it.
They were all not into it, man. It was like, it was hard for me to find folks
people
that could
play. People don't realize how open-minded people are now about punk. It's no problem. But in those older days, especially if they kind of knew how to play,
yeah.
They were like, fuck it.
Yeah, he was like, I can play in 7/4. I'm not going to play that shit. You know?
Well, their whole take on music was kind of like sports.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's
yeah.
A different vibe.
Yeah, and punk was so, I mean, it was a whole thing, you know. It was like you know, against so much of the jockishness, you know. Anyways, you know, where I was. And so we had our own little version of a punk scene and some friends booking some shows. And
so you guys make another band.
We make another band. I mean, over the years we had about 40 drummers. My brother writes screenplays. One of his first screenplays he wrote was about all these drummers we had, you know, because it was so comical. This endless parade of trying to fit
drummers.
People in, you know, and Jesus, and
but you never want to expand like 4-piece or 5-piece.
No, we did a couple times. We had a couple extra guitar players here and there.
Oh, wow.
But it would always go
augmented.
Come back. But nobody could stand, you know, because we're brothers.
And yeah.
So nobody could stand to be in the same room with us when we're fighting, you know?
Yeah. You meat puppets.
Totally. I think I'm.
We're going to continue with this. We're at the end of the first hour. October 4th, 2011, first hour Watt for Pedro show. Hold tight. Hear more from Brother Devin Hoff and his music journey. Hold tight for hour two.
Yeah.
Really?
Well, it's deep stuff for everybody dealing with it. You know?
October 4th, 2011, second hour of the Watt from Pedro show. Thank you.
bay. Ocean liner took us from far away. Didn't mean to treat us so bad. Just the best girl I ever had. Made me cry and I said goodbye. I'm not gonna sit right down and die. And he ain't gonna make a, ain't gonna lousy dime. Don't come back, I swear I'm out of my mind. So if you ever come back to stay, it's gonna be a bad day at all. You got my baby by the San Francisco Bay. Wonder which way to go. And I'm crazy about each girl that you know. Won't you give me a free train? Cause I'm feeling blue. If I don't wait till the end of the line, I think you know to you. I'm not in another city. Just about to go and save. Gonna hurt my baby. And the way she used to call my name. And if she ever come back to stay, it's gonna be a bad day at all. Walking from my baby by the San Francisco Bay.
home, and I want to welcome you out to another day at the ballpark. We were here to witness a spectacular special, otherwise known as the game of baseball. The players are taking the field, and we're set to witness an event which will make it even the boldest men rise in attention. Oh, yeah, this one's going to be a banger. First batter steps into the box. Oh, this guy's deadly. All hot dog and no bun. And folks, that guy's got a handful of nuts. Pitches his hand and gets ready to deliver the first ball of the game. Onlookers marvel as he lets it loose. Almost! Up next, he's a man known for taking a big one. Swing, that is. He's gripping that wood like he wants to shove it down the pitcher's throat. Oh, yeah. You gotta love it when Big Rod gets into his groove.
Fire and power.
Watt for Pedro show. Start off the second hour with some bass stuff. Actually started with Charles Mingus doing Fables of Fabus, and we were just talking before Crash made me go into a repeat mode here, so it's going to be a little different spiel, but Mr. Mingus went in Fabus was last governor, not last governor, but he was the governor during this period in Arkansas when they were trying to end Jim Crow. And, it ain't going to happen here. Well, yeah, it did. Mm. And Mr. Mingus, expressed his wishes through his music. Mm. Which you might think jazz being an intellectual and a instrumental music that, well, what's this? This isn't Woody Guthrie. Mm-hmm. But actually, this kind of spirit common to both those composers.
I think.
Guthrie and Mr. Mingus. Mm. And then we heard Bertram Tereski, who's a stand-up player that I got to play with and meet once. He's like Mr. Mingus, stand-up player. Comrade Devin, too, stand-up player. In fact, Mr. Mingus was dead set against electrics. I read stuff. Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Heavy belige.
Yeah.
He said, yeah, I heard of... I guess Nat King Cole had a cat work in one of these.
Uh-huh.
Actually, it was a stand-up going through an amp.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't a Fender bass. Yeah. Those were total kazoos in his book.
Yeah.
But that
even
was
going through the amp, yeah, sure.
And then in this book I was reading, some A&R man at a label set up something for him and a fusion player.
Ooh, I'm not going to say this guy's name. Didn't go well.
But he got belittled. He wanted to show him take the A train.
Uh-huh.
I don't need to learn no take the A train and shit like this. And so maybe that's why he was uppity on the on the electric bass, because some of these, maybe it would have been different in Jamerson or something. This cat, like,
yeah, exactly.
It was a bad thing. So
wow.
Anyway, Mr. Tereski, a practitioner of this thing called extended technique, which means you go beyond the traditional ways of working the stand up. Which is, I guess, between the nut and the bridge. This guy plays on the other sides, plays everywhere on the thing. And our common friend, Nels Klein, has hit me the fact that composers have written pieces expressly for Bertram Tereski.
Yeah, he's got a whole, because the vocabulary is so different.
And you can work that for that, so why not make a piece around it?
Yeah.
And we heard his tribute to Charles Mingus called Mingus. And then we heard something... this bass player named Colin Hodgkin, and him by himself doing some kind of funny title. Walking My Baby Down the San Francisco Bay. But this cat, man, he can play. And he plays with a pick, a left-hander. I don't know, do you have a thing with the pick?
I'm all for it, you know.
Yeah, there's a kind of jock thing. It's not as strong anymore, but it used to be
against the pick, yeah, sure.
Which is ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know, whatever it takes, man.
This
word you mentioned a little while ago, vocabulary, widen it, man.
Yeah.
I've seen Atmos will play a pick and fingers and slapping in the same tune.
Yeah.
And then we heard the band that Colin was in the 70s called Backdoor, and this was a band not a lot of people, like gig goers, might have known them, but they were big to musicians. And we were speaking, actually, Devin ain't heard of them, so but he's going to check them out now. And the Beastie Boys were big into this band when they were starting to play again and doing Check Your Head. And incredible band. Mrs. T had kind of a same kind of lineup, this band Bazooka. Vince Maroney, he was in my pair of pliers as a drummer.
Mm.
He was actually a sax man with El Grupo Sexo, and they went and put together this trio. And there's something about sax, drums, bass that's kind of neat, huh?
Yeah.
We were talking about that at Goldman Bust Out Brigade. You want to bring in a drumming and a sax.
That's my thought, yeah. And then we can
function.
Some
East Bay gays, right?
Maybe so, yeah.
I remember the gig we did. Remember the benefit?
Yeah.
And bring in, it will.
It's
just a matter of time, because my intent is real strong to do that. But not to jump the gun. We should get back to you're making punk bands with your brothers. There's a revolving cast of drummers.
yeah. Heavily revolving. We finally, around the time, at the same time I'm trying to learn how to play jazz, and I'm just kind of gigging.
So you got a stand-up bass.
Yeah.
How'd that happen?
Well, I had a really cool teacher. This guy would go to, like, the summer music camp at my high school, and the local high school music teacher was this guy, Steve McNeil, who's a really wonderful human.
Oh, so you were playing in the school band.
I was playing in the school orchestra, so I was just borrowing the school bass.
Oh, so the string bass there, okay.
Yeah, and then at some point along the way, my dad got me an electric bass, and he was working in a music store, so that helped that thing at that point. And then...
Was it Fender?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, my first bass was like a Hondo or something, just to see if it would take, you know what I mean? Something
I remember Hondos.
Yeah, the Hondo Alien didn't have a headstock, you know?
Oh, wow. Crane had a Hondo.
Oh, yeah? Yeah.
Trumpet player.
It's like a thing, man. And then I wound up getting on a Fender on a jazz bass. And I was borrowing the bass from my school back at the time when, you know, I was lucky enough to come in when public schools had not just music programs, but instruments that they would let the kids hang on to.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So I hung on to this bass for 6 years.
Wow.
You know, all the way up to almost to the end of high school. And then I'm getting into this thing where I think I don't even know if we knew, you know, we thought we were very punk rock, and I thought I was a little bit of a whatever. So I didn't need school anymore, so I kind of stopped going to school. And my grandma had just retired. She did like secretarial work at a construction company, and she just retired. And so she basically bribed me. There was a friend of the family who was selling an upright for cheap, which is still the only upright I've ever owned, because he needed some money because his wife was pregnant. And she said, well, if I buy this upright bass for you, will you finish high school?
Yeah.
And so she put down some cash with her retirement money, which was, you know, at the time I was young, but I still appreciated it. But as I've grown older, I've appreciated it more and more.
Yeah.
Know? She really kept me in it.
And what was these summer camps?
Yeah, they were like just like summer. Well, you know, because I played in the high school orchestra and the junior high orchestra, and there would be like summer programs, so you could keep at it year long. And this guy Steve McNeil would set up these things.
And this is they start showing you jazz stuff.
Yeah, it started showing me. It taught me how to read music. When I was too young for it to be a problem, you know, I was just excited. Like, here's the note. Well, that's what it looks like on paper.
Yeah,
so it just came at the same time. Yeah, he was a super. I was really lucky, you know. Like, I'm in this town, kind of in the middle of nowhere, in a lot of ways, and to have a guy like that, there's just a few of those people around that really, you know, they show an interest, and I was lucky enough. I was excited. I don't think I had any talent at all. I think I just had ambition for it, you know.
Yeah.
But not to get anywhere with it, but just to do it. Yeah, I just love the music.
I want to work this fucking thing.
Yeah, I mean that's never stopped. That's still just what I wake up every day and think about, you know. So I was really lucky to have somebody like that around, and started through my dad's friends, got a few jazz gigs, and then I'm doing this, you know, and I didn't know what I was doing playing jazz. I didn't come till later, but everybody needed a bass player, just like every rock band needed a bass player.
Yeah.
You show up and you bring one and you get $50, you know, or something, you know. So I was like, all right. So I was working by the time I was in high school. I was working a lot, you know, just because there was demand, you know. And so I bought my first $300 car from a friend of the family and drove around. I thought it was real cool, you know.
How could you get it in there?
I put the seat down.
Okay.
Put the passenger seat down and lay it on the back in like an old Plymouth. And then my brother and I at the same time have punk bands, and I had a separate punk band with some other friends of mine called the Vermicious Canids.
And you're using the Fender in that.
Using
band.
The Fender in that, yeah. And so then my brother leaves town, and eventually I think I got to leave town too. I got to do something because I felt like there was a need to try to explore some more stuff, because at that point my town was still small.
Yeah.
You know, and Bill Stevenson and people like that weren't there yet, you know. So I was like, we knew Bill at that point, but he didn't. And he was always, him and Carl, especially Carl Alvarez, the bass player, they were both so, so great to all of us kids. It was, you know, but anyway, so I said, yeah, I'll go out to San Francisco, because a lot of this punk rock that we were listening to was stuff, it was SST stuff, it was the Minutemen, it was, you know, Black Flag, Descendants, and post-SST stuff, you know, or stuff that went around it, like Firehose and some X, you know, but it was all California stuff. And then at that time, there was all this stuff happening up in the Bay Area.
Yeah.
That was real cool in, like, the early 90s.
Yeah.
It was a great scene up there, so we said, you know, let's go out there and, like, try to get in that scene. And so that's how I got to California. And we played a bunch, you know, and there's a bunch of great bands that we played with and great folks out there. And eventually it kind of fizzled out because we didn't know exactly what to do. We didn't even think of it. Like, yeah, it'd be great if we could get, like, on, you know, Lookout or AT or something. We never once dropped a tape off anywhere. You know what I mean? We would just, because we were rednecks, you know, we would,
yeah,
like, we were
out.
Like, we can't, they wouldn't like us, you know, and we'd meet somebody that was cool, and they'd say, yeah, you should, then we never did it, you know.
Wow.
We never knew how to do that stuff, it just didn't
but,
occur to us. We made a
million
demo
tapes. We're playing with some people.
Yeah.
You're playing the gigs.
We're playing the gigs, we're showing up, and so we're like, but, you know, we just, and we made our demo tapes, we just hand them out at the gigs, you know. That was good enough for us. That was exciting. We, you know, back when, like, the Purple Onion was happening,
oh, okay.
The Chameleon and these kinds of places.
Yeah.
That was a blast, man. That was a great scene, you know. We were happy just, we had our day gigs and just happy to have the gig on the weekend at that point.
That's where you meet Scott?
Yeah, I met Scott when I was started, well, after that band fell apart, I started getting into the jazz scene and starting to really try to learn how to play now and got thrown in the deep water way above my head. And it was great. It was wonderful. There was a drummer named Derek Phillips who I'm befriended through another friend, and he just took me under his wing and started taking me around, introducing me to people, and literally taking me to sessions and saying, check out this bass player. He's sounding pretty good. He, you know, pretty soon I was making a living doing that because there was that scene was happening. And Derek's playing with, he's played with Charlie Hunter over the years and a bunch of different people. He and I were playing with that guy Vijay Iyer for a while, and that's when I got into that band, was through Derek. So he hooked me up with people, and through that I started meeting all these other cats, and I met Scott, which is who eventually I met Nels through.
Yeah, that's why I brought him up.
Yeah.
Would Scott have his own band? Is that what you started playing for?
No, I think at that point there was it was another guy's band that we played in the first time that, you know, I just met him kind of on the rhythm section on a couple of things.
Yeah.
You know, and that was really cool, and I knew of him, you know, his reputation of course already preceded him at that point, because he had been, you know, plugging away in the Bay Area for years.
Yeah, right.
You know? So he had a great reputation there, and I met him and we started talking, and I was like coming out of jazz and coming out of punk rock, you know. Trying to get into jazz and coming out of punk rock, and he said, well, you should meet this guy Nels Klein. And of course, I said, you know, my eyes lit up and I looked like an anime character all of a sudden, you know. So I'm like, Nels Klein? Because I discovered Nels is playing through Ball Hog and Tugboat, through your record.
Oh, wow.
You know, so I discovered that.
I think he's on the most tunes. It's
I think
like
so.
On five tunes on that one.
Yeah, and so I was into that record, of course, and I was, you know, well, I missed the Minutemen. I saw Firehose, you know, a few times when they came through town, but... And they came through, you guys came through Colorado, but sadly never got to see the Minutemen. But I was all excited about that, and I was a big fan of what you were doing, and even of Dose at that point. And then Ball Hog came out, and I discovered Nels, and I was like, now this guy, I read some stuff about him, and I found some interviews, and I think I heard...
He also had his own band, The Trio.
Yeah, The Trio. I think I heard Chester, one of those records,
okay,
and I was like, now that's kind of this thing where it's like... Like where Process of Weeding Out came in.
Yeah.
You know, that was huge to me because
Black
I was...
Black Flag Instrumental.
Yeah, because I was like thinking about, you know, free jazz and hearing the punk rock and hearing them kind of put together. And it wasn't like what you were saying. It wasn't fusion. It was this other thing. It's kind of like what you were saying about these guys nowadays. There's, I think, a lot of young people that come out of a lot of punk rock aesthetic and ideology.
Yeah.
But that are also into this thing of you can play too and you can create this other energy without being fusion.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it's like, you know, kids that came up listening to that stuff, came up listening to you guys, came up listening to some of Zorn's older stuff.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? Came up understanding like some of the energy in Mingus's stuff that's, you know, in the Albert Eiler and all that. And it's really exciting. So I was one of those people, you know. I just
Well,
was really
Coltrane,
excited.
You know. When Raymond played me Coltrane, I thought he was a punk rocker.
Yeah, absolutely.
I thought they were older. I didn't know he was dead. I didn't know any because I didn't grow up with any bebop. No, I grew up in Navy housing, so I had no idea.
Wow.
I didn't know it was 10 years. He had died 10 years before. This is late 70s.
So Pettibone played.
And yeah, it was this wild music. To me, I was it was different style a little bit, but to me the. But that's, of course, natural because they're different bands.
Yeah.
But this kind of emotion and trip where what I felt was real close.
Yeah, yeah.
Was really close. You know, maybe you should play for people.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, Devin brought his bass here. This is the first one with that. Yeah,
that's the first one, man. Still the only one, man. It's like a... It's a really cool bass. I'm so used to it, you know? I don't know, man.
That's entitled?
Yeah, I'm just...
For the Watford Pedro Show on October 4th, 2011. That was beautiful. Now, people you didn't see, but you could probably hear, there was no fingers. That was called arco, where they use a bow.
Yeah, the whole
which time. Is something you can't really do. on a bass guitar. I've seen the Cat in the Creation did it on guitar. Yeah, and then Jimmy Page did it later. Mm-hmm.
Sometimes if I really work at it and I have the bow around, I can get a few notes out. But there has to be like some overdrive or something on the electric to to bring it out.
Yeah.
But I've been working on it more on this thing. Cause
well, it was built for it.
Yeah,
well, in a way,
exactly,
you know.
Literally, it was built for it.
Yeah, it's like a giant violin without the chin thing.
Yeah, it totally is. It's like a violin.
They just upscaled it.
Yeah, which was, I don't know much about it, but from what I've read, it's, I don't think of the best design in the world. You know, it's the idea that, like, we take the small thing and we'll just make it bigger on the same scale.
Steroid it up.
It's not necessarily
you see, they did that with a lot of things.
Yeah.
Huh? Mandolins. There was
yeah.
the whole orchestra is a different
yeah, totally.
Size.
The bass mandolin.
And you can see it with the sax. There's a tenor. There's
yeah.
a soprano, a baritone. This whole idea of you can't come up on it, then just find a bigger, a lower or higher voice for it. But kind of notes, physics operate a little different.
Exactly. Yeah, the physics operate different. And even the sound projection is different. You
yeah.
know what I mean? So...
This guy, they're beautiful. I tried a couple years. I had this thing called Little Pit where I played. I did one recording with this.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah,
with
it was
bow?
For a Who song.
Oh, right on.
What was it? Two drummers. George Hurley was one of the drummers. I don't know, but... Oh, and Steve Perkins was the other one.
Whoa.
It was a cover of Helpless Dancer, or what Georgie called it, Toothless Prancer. It's off the Quadrophenia thing.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. It was in Long Beach. God, I wonder what happened to that. That would have been wild. So, through Scott, you meet Nels.
Yeah, through Scott I meet Nels.
And the band called Nels Klein Singers.
Yeah, it comes out of that, which just happened really quickly, you know, at that same time. I was kind of just starting to really get into... delve more into like the avant-garde world of things, especially the current avant-garde world thing at the time, you know, so.
Which you would say is separate from jazz.
I don't know. I think that, I don't know.
Is there a debate about that?
There's a debate about it. There's a debate about it, but I don't know if I want to even, if
yeah.
I even know enough to weigh in on it, because to me it's kind of all semantics, yeah.
Sure, because
yeah.
in the big scheme of thing, music is music.
Yeah, and like...
genre is just marketing shit.
And when you look at, I think...
But you did say... I only say that because you said avant-garde.
Oh,
yeah. You had been... You'd taken the dive in the Fort Collins jazz. Now you're San Francisco jazz. Now you say...
Yeah.
Avant-garde.
Well, I think at that point I was... You know, people like... I became really obsessed with this bass player, Joelle Leandre.
Mm.
And I got really super into her stuff. And I still am in a...
Yeah. Respect.
And at that point, I was every time I played, you know, I was playing tunes always and only, you know, and like playing jazz tunes and trying to get.
Do you have a fake book?
Yeah, you know, and trying to learn all the tunes and trying to transcribe the solos and, you know, playing like ding 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 gigs, you know, like trying to play a good walking line was like all I was caring about, and that was really fun.
Yeah.
And really worthwhile. And then I was at this festival with this guy, Idris Akamor, this sax player from the Bay Area, and his band. And I was over in Europe somewhere, and somebody just turned me on to her, said, oh, you should check out this bass player. And it kind of blew my mind.
Yeah.
And so then it kind of exploded everything, and I started picking up the bow again more, and studying all this stuff, and thinking more about this kind of stuff, and listening to folks coming from, like, maybe not necessarily a jazz approach to improvising.
You know... light years from me, but the Walker jazz guy for me was Paul Chambers.
Oh,
that
me too.
Guy walk a fucking line.
Oh, it's the most beautiful thing,
you
man.
You drive a semi-truck on those bass lines.
Totally, man. Yeah.
And throwing 10 million changes, and the fucker's going to have that thing.
Yeah.
So, man, he was something.
He was amazing, man. He's
Train wrote a song for him.
Yeah,
Mr.
PC.
Yeah.
Yeah, man, I really...
He could walk and swing it. Man,
mm-hmm.
He's something.
He's probably my... I mean, I don't know if you get into, like, favorites and stuff, but I think he's probably the top guy for me for a jazz guy. I love...
He's incredible.
Yeah.
And all fucked up like that.
I know, it's so crazy.
How?
I know. I love his feel, man. His feel is so, like,
yeah.
had so much energy and buoyancy, and it's crazy to think that if he's on Smack when that's happening. That's amazing to even contemplate.
I know, but man, when I think of, for some reason, my mind always goes, because I hear him on those songs. I know he's on some train, of course, and he loved him, but he ended up with Jimmy, who's a much different player.
I love Jimmy, too, a lot, I have to
say. There's a book I got, look, I got the reference about myself.
Oh, you got everything right there.
I got a whole bunch of others here, but I got the reference, all the gigs.
Oh, man, all the gigs.
About when that was a present to myself. But I got a book here on his interviews.
Uh-huh.
Train on Train.
Nice.
Right here. And he's talking about bass, he's the tonality. And that's what he dug about Jimmy.
About Jimmy, yeah.
Was the tonality.
Yeah.
Yeah, isn't that trippy?
It's a trip. I mean,
and, you know, there's a, because a lot of people, the bass don't have a tone, right? It's just a feel. It's just a pushing.
Yeah, but for him, it's like where that
there's this interview I got with him speaking where they asked him about what he's listening to when he's soloing, and he said the bass.
Really?
So I think he was really conscious.
Conscious of him.
Bass players, but in a trippy way, not in such a connect the dots way.
Right.
You know?
Well, that's a heavy thought. I'm going to have to think on that for a
while. You hear her in this notion of avant-garde that you can take the bass out.
Mm-hmm.
You're playing with Nels, though, at the time.
Yeah. Well, that's right when I started playing with Nels and so on. And there's a lot of other things I was hearing. But
I mean, you know, he told me about, I remember when I first started playing, he says, yeah, I found a guy, man. He was really into your playing.
Oh, that's nice, man. No, I love him and his playing and everything. It was a really...
How many years? Six?
Ten.
Ten?
Yeah. It was a really great nod of him to me, too. It really, helped.
10 years. Wow.
Yeah. Nobody knew me from Adam as far as the scenes that Nels was involved in, you know, and here I was, I'd been playing, jazz gigs in the Bay Area is, all I'd really had a resume for besides some, playing a punk gig at the Purple Onion or something, what I mean?
Right.
That's about it, so it was really, he was really, taking a chance, and I think maybe, it was wonderful for me, you know what I mean?
Was it scary at first? No?
You know, it wasn't too scary. The first rehearsal, I was like, what's this going to be like? And then
leaves you a lot of room.
He leaves you a lot of room. Yeah.
Just charts out some figures.
Once he talked about everything, he said that his music was going to operate between fascism and anarchism. And there's going to be times when it's anarchy, and everybody's there for themselves to do with as they choose, and there's times when it's fascism, and he's laying down the parts for everyone.
Yeah.
And he said that, and I thought, okay, I can understand that. And he was so clear about where things would be going. And that whole punk, jazz, and not just those words, but just those kinds of feelings.
Yeah.
More than the sounds, even.
Yeah.
You know, or the sounds associated with feelings, if that makes any sense. It was so much where my head was at, and where my head is still at in a lot of ways, that I was just so excited to jump on board. I was just more excited than anything. You know what I mean? Whereas, when I'd been playing with that guy, Vijay Iyer, really previously to that gig scared the hell out of me, because everything was odd times and really complex harmony, and I was definitely that was the knuckle dragger of the group, you know what I mean? I was holding everybody back.
Slow
learner, and just,
the slow learner.
Wait, guys, what's going on, you know? That music was so hard, and it was so beautiful that I wanted to play it well, and, you know. So I think that wore me out from being worried about a gig, because the nights before Vijay's gigs, I could never sleep a wink. I'd just be laying awake thinking about... Yeah.
Like the big yardsticks were going to be brought out.
Totally, that's exactly what I was worried about, you know? You know, we played, with Vijay's band, one of, the bigger gigs. I didn't do it that band for too long, because they all moved to New York, and I couldn't go at the time, but... one of the first gigs we did was, at this jazz festival, and... Dave Holland plays solo.
And that's a bass man.
Yeah, and he plays solo for an hour before us. It was a double bill. And I'm just like, no, man. What are you talking about? I'm supposed to play after that? And then the first tune we do, Vijay looks at me and he says, all right, you got it. Like, the first solo on the first tune was going to be me. And I was like, oh, no. I can't. Yeah. And Vijay did that. He did that to break my jitters. He could tell I had some jitters. He wanted me to play some and let it out of my system, you know? But yeah, so Nels' stuff, I was just excited about, and I was I was just so happy to be there and be doing it. And
one time you told me the recordings though were trippy.
With Nels's band?
Yeah.
Yeah, they could be. Yeah. It was a band that live made was really, really easy. The recordings we would do okay because we would always finish ahead of schedule.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, for the days that we had and stuff. But I'd always be like in an ISO booth with headphones on so you could record the upright without just cymbals and guitar being in there. And that, for music that's so improvised, that feels weird because it's like, it's going to...
attached.
Yeah, it's going to kind of break the vibe. Yeah.
Yeah, you called. I remember you telling me once, man, I wish I could go back.
Yeah. Oh, man, that's the truth. There was a tune of Nels's that... a couple of times we had really toured on the stuff, you know, and knew it.
Yeah.
You know, and of the records we did, I think, 4 or 5 as the singers and a couple others as different, you know, with the new Monastery band. They did the Andrew Hill thing with Bobby Bradford and Andrea and Ben. And then the Ed Ruscha record thing, too, you know, which was a different thing. But other than that, the singers' records.
Dirty Baby.
But the singers' records, a couple of the times, like about half of the tunes we would know, and there'd always be stuff that we didn't know yet. And so we're learning it kind of in the studio right before. There's a tune on either the second or third record called Bright Moon that I'll never forget. It's a long bass solo on it over all these harmony, you know, that Nels wrote, all these chord changes, and they're all like Nels stuff where his fingers are doing all these crazy things and the tonality's going 2 different places at once. It was beautiful chord changes. And so we're playing it, and I'm like, cool, we're going to get this, you know, this will sound pretty good. Then we're rehearsing it, you know, and that I'm just practicing over the chord changes, you know. Just playing like straight just playing arpeggios or just trying to figure out some way on the bass to get through these chord changes because I was stumped by them, frankly, you know. I didn't know what to do and I was nervous to record
it. Some guy's named Flanagan over Giant Steps.
Yeah, Tommy Flanagan, yeah, that's the story. And then
because he didn't even crack it, right?
Yeah, and he's just like...
Coltrane says, here's some chords.
Yeah, and he's just like, okay.
He's got
solid. That's a terrible thing, man. Because he's such a wonderful musician.
I heard he kept doing recordings of it over and over.
Just to be like, I got it now, man.
I got it.
You show somebody. Yeah, it was kind of like that. It was not nearly that as extreme of a situation. But on this case, we finished this rehearsal take, and it was like, cool, I think that's the take. That's it. And I was like, you mean we were tracking? You know, and he's like, yeah. And I was like, well, let's do another one. He goes, no, that was good.
It's done.
I was like, man, I was practicing. So every time I hear that solo, I just laugh because it doesn't sound that bad in retrospect, but at the time it felt like it was just, I mean, you'll hear it if you listen to it, it's just a string of 8th notes, you know,
right,
there's no space at all. It's just the bass player trying to figure out the changes.
Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain.
Yeah, well, Tommy Flanagan, though, man, but that guy could sure play, though. He's
I know.
God, it's so
but
sad.
But that was some chords to lay out there.
That's some hearts. And that's the first time that people had done those kinds of changes.
And now people use it to cut each other.
Yeah.
Which is so lame because Train's heart was so big, he would never use music to cut someone.
Yeah, man, that's a really good point.
Isn't that weird?
I
humans do this to everything nice.
Yeah, they make everything totally. They make punk rock into car commercials, and they make Coltrane's music into cutting stuff.
Yeah, cutting to make you somebody feel little and lame.
Yeah, man. Yeah, and everything you hear. Last year when I was in Chicago, 2 years ago, I think it was last year at the Jazz Festival, the Umbrella Festival there, which is an amazing jazz festival. Some friends of mine put on. It's really beautiful, and that I think it's called Trio 3. It's Oliver Lake and Reggie Workman and Andrew Surreal. And it's just a beautiful, beautiful band. And I saw them play this gig.
It's Chambers on the... But he's on that album.
He's on some of that stuff, yeah.
He's not a,
and he's on
the song. It's
yeah,
Chambers
and he's
on
some of those records right around then. I think he was...
Oh, yeah, I think he's on Giant Steps, too, but not that song.
Oh, okay, yeah. Yeah, that might be.
He was there in the... This is when Train's doing his first band.
Yeah, exactly, you know.
Right, he's Sideman 10 years.
Yeah. And so, you know, Reggie's still playing. It still sounds great.
Yeah.
Those guys, they played this beautiful, amazing set. And my friend said, you got to go upstairs and meet them. And I said, oh, okay. I was shy, too, but I had to pay my respects.
Yeah.
You know, when I had the invitation to. And anyway, it was such a trip because all these men start talking about Coltrane. You know, and they all knew him and hung with him back in the day. And they're talking with him with such reverence, talking about him with such reverence and such love.
Wow.
You know, it's such a beautiful thing because it didn't come out scripted by anybody. They start telling stories. You know, just backstage after their gig. You know.
Wow.
Yeah, it was pretty amazing to be near.
That would have been me. We're at the end of the second hour.
Hmm.
October 4th, 2011, Watch Peter Show. One from Devin Hoff. Hold tight for hour three. October 4th, 2011, is the Watch from Pedro Show. Here's that Italian jazz chord stuff I was telling you about. Thank you.
jukebox sound. Are you ready for the jukebox sound? Ready for the jukebox sound? Are you ready for the jukebox sound? Ready for the jukebox sound? Are you ready for the jukebox sound? Ready for the jukebox sound? Are you ready for the jukebox sound? Ready for the jukebox sound? Are you ready for the jukebox sound? Ready for the jukebox sound?
Watch for Pedro show. Start out the third hour with music from this scene in Italy called Jazzcore. Started with Neo doing Invenzione Una. Then Sagari. That's actually got a U.S. guy on piano, but Italiano's on the other stuff. Thousands More Locked Up Today, Master. That's her new album. And then we heard T-Rex by Tubax. T-Rex.
Nice.
First gig I went to. But doesn't sound too much like Mark Bolan. I said this was jazz chord. Actually, this next band's from Ireland. They're called the Redneck Manifesto, and a tune called Black Apple.
Nice.
And there's some of this kind of music happening in Tokyo, too. My buddies in Light do this kind of stuff. Yeah. So to say it's all coming out of Italy would be crazy. I think people want to make things simple.
Uh-huh.
So they want generalizations, and it's not fair to human beings.
Yeah, man, I totally...
You got to be sensitive to nuance and all this stuff. And I guess what happened with artists with... I think it was somebody like Marcel Duchamp and how he had to... First, there was... postmodern, and then there was futurist, and then Dada, and I guess modern first, not postmodern. Modern, and then futurist, and Dada, and surrealism, and then postmodern, and he navigated all this.
Right.
Probably because he had to. Otherwise, you would sink with the scene.
Right, right.
Right?
Totally, and then you're... Yeah.
Crazy. Oh, then finally we heard something from Serbia. Yeah. Ataje to sto duja danas droz paju by Disciplina Kičman. And this bass man, Disciplina Kičman, his name's Koya, and he's been around for years out of there. He went to England for a little while, but mainly he's been out of Belgrade. This guy, you got to see him. He plays electric bass, but sometimes wow and stuff. And
whoa.
He's a monster.
Oh, awesome.
Beautiful cat, and his bands are... This is different versions of... For a while, he had like two trumpets, bass, and drums.
Whoa.
And a singer.
That's real cool.
He sings too.
And with electric bass.
Yeah.
So the bass takes up all this other room.
Well, it's supposed
that's
to
nice.
Being left.
Yeah,
to be
exactly.
And he can use distortion, and he does chords. And
well, it's like, yeah.
He does all kinds of stuff. He's great bass man.
It's like with Dose, though. Cool, you take some of the other stuff away, and then you can say, oh, that's what's happening, you know?
10 years. What, well, six, seven albums?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think all told about that. A couple of them are double records, though. So,
that's right.
So do you count those? I never know if I can count those as two
and then,
or one.
And many tours, I know, U.S. and overseas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
And then this was all you were doing musically.
No, the singers?
Yeah.
No, I was doing other stuff at the time, too.
Okay.
I had that band Good for Cows.
That's right,
with,
of course.
With Chess Smith. And that band still functions when it's like...
When did that come around? Was that in the middle of the Singers?
It was right before the Singers, actually.
Before the Singers?
Yeah.
Because he was living in the Bay Area at the time.
Yeah, before he moved to New York.
I've played much Good for Cows on the show here.
Yes.
Yeah, of course. I didn't work it in the timeline where it was happening.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
But, okay, so it's right before the Singers. So you were doing that concurrently.
Yeah.
And then there were some other things, too. What, the Zhushu?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, which I've... worked on and off over the years with that band, you know, with Jamie, who's the main songwriter in that band, just did a bass part by mail for their last record, you know, and
he likes to take different directions and stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
totally. Very
but
different.
You toured with them too, right?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Good for Cows tour?
Good for Cows toured some, but not enough. Ever, you know what I mean? It was always hard to find.
Because he had a lot of things going too.
Yeah,
he's an incredible drummer.
He's an incredible drummer, and it was sometimes the kind of band that with like an opening tour would work better, but with us we just never would have enough of a draw to do a long tour, you know, by ourselves. We just would. It was hard to get the ball rolling for some reason on that. In Europe, we've done a couple and probably do some more hopefully. So. For some reason, it's a little bit easier with that music
year?
Over there.
Did you have an album last year?
Yeah,
right?
We did.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, on the Web of Mimicry label. And that was
I played some. Is that the all black one?
Yeah, that's the all black one. Okay. Where I play electric bass on that record.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah, we had pushed this other idea obsessively so far that it was just time to try something else. So we did a louder record, you know. I played electric bass and Chess did some.
But there was changes with the singer. Who's Trevor Dunn?
Trevor Dunn, yeah.
He's pretty incredible.
Yeah, he's a great bass player and a good friend. Yeah.
From Bungle?
Uh-huh.
Right?
Patton? Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I...
Yeah, really good at that musician.
I kind of... I ended up bowing out of the singers as gracefully as I could when I was in Chicago just because of a variety of things going on.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That happened in the meantime, too. You left Bay Area and you went to Chicago.
I went to Chicago and hung out there, and so I ended up...
Yeah, because I remember Nels telling me he was very sad.
Oh, it was a hard thing. It seemed like creatively, because I just didn't feel like it. I wasn't hearing it. You know what I mean?
This was just the double album.
Yeah, the most recent one. Yeah, I just the studio.
Well,
there
were some trippy things.
Yeah,
you tried on that one, right? That were way different.
Yeah, way different. I enjoyed doing it and making the record, but I just felt like. Like, I think that maybe there's a... I think I was more comfortable in the, like, punk jazz, you know, phase of things. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's just... And that's kind of... And I just felt like there was some things that he was wanting to do with that band. And not like we even had a big... Never an argument or anything. But I just said, you know, I think that you want to do some things that I'm not... I don't really have a connection to personally, and you know,
yeah.
Like you know, he has a lot of roots in like 70s like fusion,
yeah.
Like you know, Weather Report and stuff like this and music.
Who was that cat? He was a Czech man, right?
Zawinul? No.
Well, he was the boss.
Oh yeah, he was Austrian.
Bass man. They had a
Miroslav. Yeah. And I just have no connection at all to that music.
Yeah.
I hear it and I don't even.
Well, there was some Jaco.
Yeah.
Years too.
Some Jockeys here. I just don't understand it. Not like they're not to badmouth that or.
No, of course not.
Or Nels's appreciation.
I want
of
you
it.
To. Let's play another one on the.
Yeah.
Basic.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, there's.
I know people would want me to ask you about why is it
yeah.
Devin and singers anymore, and so that's why I had to ask that.
Yeah, sure. It's all good. What should I play? Should I play it?
Yeah, you're totally right. Thank you.
Is that guy name?
No.
That's called improvising, people.
Yeah, something.
We're going to play something from the Goat.
Yeah.
Goat Tet.
Awesome. Nels and Alex, man.
Right, the twins.
And Joel.
Thank you.
Watt for Pedro show. First we heard 40 Lashes with Mascara from Jeff Gaultier Gotet. And he's a violin man.
Mm-hmm.
He's pretty incredible. And yeah, that's Alex Klein on the drums and Nels the guitar and Joel Hamilton. Not the Studio G one, but...
the bass playing.
Yeah, the other one. Here, let's put the mic.
Oh, right on. Yeah, and Jeff had that Cryptogramophone as his record,
that's
his
right,
record label, which did a great service in getting all this music out of different folks that, you know, in a time when it was unclear who,
sure,
if anybody, would release some,
right,
a bunch of that, you know?
And then we heard something you might know called Slipped Away.
Huh.
Do you remember that?
Yeah, I do. It's the last song on the
Singers,
on the first record. That's one of my favorite songs of that band. I love that song.
Yeah. Yeah. Beautiful, beautiful.
Nell's on the baritone on that one, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're asking me about the Black Gang. I made a Black Gang album that hasn't been mixed yet. And, you know, people say that first take feel. Well, you can do that with Nell's.
Yeah.
I wrote all these songs. I brought them into the studio and just... played for Bob Lee was shitting a pecan log, you know. He goes, "Well, I never practiced any of that." I said, "Don't worry, man.
It'll be fine."
This guy, yeah, he used 36 pedals. He used, and he went back and overdubbed electric sitar and electric 12 string.
Mm-hmm.
I asked him. I said, "Nels, will you try to play your most psychedelic?"
Well, oh, I bet he loves
hearing
that.
My songs and stuff. It's actually a Nels Klein tour de force.
Yeah.
This album.
So was Contemplating the Engine Room in a lot of ways. That's,
yeah, it was
one
too.
Of my favorite Nels Klein
records.
It was
done the same way.
Uh huh.
Never heard any of the tunes.
Oh, really?
I had an easel there. I explained the whole story. You know, I put
yeah.
the whole life of the Minutemen in one day.
Wow. That's the
first opera. Yeah.
Oh, that's, yeah,
I,
yeah.
I used my pop's life in the Navy as a metaphor. For the band.
For the band, right, sure.
And then I used the Joyce idea of, like, one day.
Yeah.
So it seems like that's the basic demarcation line. You know, the sun rises, the sun sets.
Yeah.
Weeks are kind of arbitrary, you know. Months, I guess, go by the moon, and the year goes by the sun.
Mm-hmm.
For sure the week's arbitrary. So I put it all in the day. But it got weird, because if you think about it, like Loverboy, everybody's working for the weekend. All of a sudden it became very, a very concrete format.
Oh.
Even though it has no attachment to nature.
Right, right.
Right? All of a sudden people, 5 days,
absolutely.
2 days, five
yeah,
days,
people,
2 days.
People start feeling it, and it's just based on, like, the, you know.
Call Wednesday the hump day, and
yeah.
you know, all this thing, all this other cycle.
Yeah,
it really doesn't have much to do with nature. But
good,
anyway, I had the
comes
soul,
like,
and I gave, like Joyce did, each part of the day a color, and it was a part of the story. And I explained these things, not so much music words, just the story words, because I was leaving it up to him
yeah.
to realize it on the guitar. And Steve Hodges was on the drums, same thing.
Thanks.
And then using this metaphor, like the van is a boat, you know.
Uh-huh.
My pop, when I was sending him the postcards from tour, he's like, "Wow, you're like a sailor." And so it made me think
yeah.
about it.
Yeah, oh, that's
so
nice.
That's the whole idea of that piece. So when it came to do this wasn't such an opera. It was just concept. I wanted it to be about autumn.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know.
Yeah.
I'm definitely not spring, but hopefully not winter.
Yeah, man.
My life, so I was... thinking about this, I wrote these
that's
tunes
autumn.
To it, and I just laid the bass lines on him, you know, and the parts, and he just reacted to it in real time and recorded it.
Now, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Like, when you write like that, how much of the other parts are you writing? Like guitar parts and drum parts? I know that you have a lot of strong ideas about that. Are you laying those on?
Like that one?
Yeah.
No. With Nels, no. I just...
Oh, yeah.
Well, I have thematic ideas.
Uh-huh.
Now, something like the third opera, The Hyphenated Man,
uh-huh.
I wrote it all on D. Boone's guitar, so that was weird. But I don't do that much. But I wanted the bass come second, just to do it. I was using little song formats,
uh-huh.
so it was kind of going back to my Minuteman days.
Yeah.
So it was scary.
Yeah.
You know, you don't want to get Happy Days nostalgic. So I wanted to write about now, being a 53-year-old punk rocker.
Yeah.
But I wanted to use that old format because I thought it was so interesting where you don't have any filler. You just have these little things.
Yeah, man.
So I was kind of looking for him for courage. Maybe if I use his guitar, I won't be so afraid.
That's nice.
But usually when I'm on the bass, I want them to realize it with their instruments.
Right.
Because I ain't a drummer either. I have to work it out with them as they're doing it.
Mm-hmm. And tell them what feels right when they do something.
Yeah, I can't play melodic Dave Grohl out here. Here's a drum part because I can fucking play it.
Yeah. And here's a guitar part too.
And here's this and that. And fuck, I'll make the whole record by myself if I have to. And he did it. You know, like Prince or Stevie Wonder or something. But I'm not like that. I'm a bass man. But I think, in fact, interesting question. The Bass Player magazine asked me about the future of bass. Where is it going? Oh, it's more strings, of course.
Uh-huh.
No. I think this future bass playing actually is more about composition because our physics are so narrow that we leave a lot of room for the other cats.
Yeah.
So it's actually like when I'm composing a piece and ask cats to come on, because sometimes bass, I'm thinking, whoa, I'm like you when you were first doing it. They need it.
Yeah.
You know, and so we're like glue.
Yeah.
And what are we with nothing to stick to, just a puddle. But on the other way, as I've gone on and started writing on this thing, maybe it can be like springboard, and you can help launch people.
Right.
Launch people. So, you know, because most composing is done on a piano or a guitar, and a lot of melodic, a lot of harmonic content, and kind of squares it away for people.
Yeah.
The bass kind of mysterious. Even though you're laying out rhythms for them and just starts and stops, you're leaving a lot of room for them. Some people, it's too much. They want more direction.
Yeah, but it's a good point because it leaves enough room people can actually put themselves into the spaces.
Yeah, so when you're thinking, when you're asking me about what am I thinking of, I'm actually thinking blank slate.
Right.
You know, I'm the frame around the blackboard. I'm framing it up for them.
Uh-huh.
But more like the grout.
Well,
I'm not telling them what to put in the tiles so much.
Yeah.
Thematically, maybe if I'm trying to get overall idea, I'll bring in some like food words, movie words or something.
Uh-huh.
But the music words, I want that them on their machine, their personal connection with it to somehow come out. That makes us from being generic and just parts and cogs. And so in the bass, we're kind of nebulous enough where we give it that structure. We're kind of drummy, we're kind of a guitar-y, we're this weird hybrid.
Yeah.
I think we're still finding out what we are. It's this mysterious instrument.
It's true.
And it was always something to be put on after to fill things up.
And
R&B kind of changed that. They started bringing it up more. Even the left hand on the piano, where the rock and roll comes from, the boogie-woogie, we were coming up with a persona a little bit. But this not knowing is kind of interesting too, setting people up in a kind of murky situation so they can become themselves somehow. But we're kind of directing the show. We are the composers.
Yeah.
But it's a different kind of composing.
It's like that Coltrane thing you're saying, you know, to play in a minor key but without the third.
No, but never. It's a third.
It's kind of like that, because with the bass part, people hear it and they're like, it's kind of unclear exactly what rhythm or what harmony or melody to go on top of that.
So I think for the other instruments,
or next
the guitar and.
Yeah,
and drums in particular, you can set them up, and that's what I'm thinking of when I'm writing.
Wow,
I'm not really looking for the bass to be a fake drum or a fake guitar.
Right,
I'm still trying to be bass, but
whatever
trying
that is.
To be a bit of a rudder man, a little bit in a trippy way, or a point guard on the basketball court, you know, who's going to get the ball and that kind of stuff, a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But once you give them the ball, you want them to shoot their way, make their shots.
And not just finish the play you set up, but do what they have to do with it.
Actually, a lot of the times, when I'm writing it, I don't have an end picture.
Wow.
I have a kind of feeling I'm trying to get through, but I'm counting on those cats to bring out their music.
Right.
Like that. And, to me, that's what makes it interesting about that.
Yeah.
And why... Yeah, I read something about Frank Zappa said, nobody's good enough to play my compositions. See, I'm all the way on the other side. What will my compositions... It's like, okay, these are my babies.
Right.
Now, these are the households they're going to grow up in. How will they become?
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I have to let them go once they're born.
Yeah.
And even as I'm doing it with the cats in the studio, what will become? And a man like Nels Klein is like this... for me, where I can, you know, let that fucking freak flag fly.
Yeah, it's beautiful, man. That's such a great aesthetic.
You got advice? Because we're getting at the end of the show,
man, there's a lot of music I was going to play, but I ran out of time. But I'll get to it next week.
You're just such an incredible musician. What would you tell somebody getting into music?
Man, I would just say do it for the love of it and keep doing it as much as you can, no matter what, you know? And if you're stopped, prevented from doing it at some point, and you love it enough, you can find your way back into it, you know? If, you know, all the fates and the gods are willing.
Don't quit. That's your advice.
Yeah, just don't quit. Cause you don't know where it's going. You can't know.
Right.
You know? And the music itself is such beautiful stuff. You know, the Braxton thing about being all these different, following all these different spiritual and whatever paths of your life, and then realizing at one point that you're a musician and that actually is your path.
Whoa. It's been October 4th, 2011, edition of the Watt Pedro Show. Special guest, Devin Hoff. Thanks so much for coming aboard and making it righteous for me.
Dang, it was an honor, man. Really, seriously. Thank you.
Okay, everybody. Keep your powder dry.